The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with MilliQ Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.
Reading with your kids.
Hola, ni hao, konnichiwa, assalamualaikum, shalom, jambo, bienvenidos. Hi, my name is Jed Lee, and this is the Reading with Your Kids podcast. We are so delighted that you're part of our beautiful Reading with Your Kids family. And this episode was made especially for families to listen to together. We've been telling you for a while that we have a brand new podcast coming, and it debuts today. So sit back, get ready to experience Solve It for Kids.
This is Solve It for Kids.
Hey, my friends, so great to see you. Come on in. Hi, my name is Jed Lee, and this is Solve It, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using curiosity, critical thinking, and creativity. Right now, I want to introduce you to my partner in exploration, the dean of all things STEM and STEAM, and my wicked smart friend, Jennifer Swanson.
Hey, Jed. Great to be with you for the first episode of Solve It for Kids.
Jennifer, I am so excited. You know, I was thinking we should probably tell people what Solve It for Kids is all about.
I agree. So Solve It for Kids is a science podcast where we chat with scientists, experts, and engineers and talk to them about some of the problems they solve in their own jobs. So kids, listen closely because you just might hear something that will help you solve problems that you have at home or problems of the whole world. And as a fun bonus, each guest has a challenge for you to solve. So let's get creative and let's get solving.
This is excellent. I love this. We're going to get the kids involved. And every week we're going to spin this like wheel of problems and then talk to an expert that can tell us how they solve that problem. All right, let's spin the wheel right now.
Oh, hold on, Jen. Okay. So fast. First, we have to give a shout-out to our first Solve It for Kids team members.
I thought the only people on this team were like me and you.
Oh, no. Now, you know how science works and engineering works. We have to have lots of people from all different backgrounds on our team because one of the ways we learn is great things is when people come together and share their talents, ideas, and resources. And one of the ways kids can share their ideas with us is for them to become a team member of Solve It for Kids.
Hey, how does someone become a Solve It for Kids team member?
It's easy. All you have to do is invite your parents to visit our website, which is www.solveitforkids.com, and sign up.
Awesome. So who are we giving a shout out to today?
Well, we want to give a shout out to Derek in Massachusetts.
Hey, Derek, what's up? Thanks for being a member of the Solve It for Kids team. Hey, listen, if you want us to give you a shout out here in the show, please invite your parents to visit our website. Okay, Jennifer, now, can I spin the wheel of problems now?
Go for it.
How do you map an underwater forest?
Ha! Wait a minute. How do you map an underwater forest? There are underwater forests? How does a forest end up underwater?
Oh, we are going to find out. My friend, Dr. Brian Helmuth, from the Northeastern University and Nahant Marine Science Center is here to talk to us all about underwater forests. Please welcome Dr. Brian Helmuth to the show.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here.
Yay. We're excited to have you. So we kind of want to start out with, let's tell our listeners, what is an aquanaut? Like, what do you do as an aquanaut?
Yeah, I mean, an aquanaut is someone who works underwater, and I guess more specifically, who lives underwater. Ooh. So like an astronaut, as you know, goes into space, and they live in space for a certain number of days. An aquanaut lives in the bottom of the ocean. And so that's part of what we do for my job.
So, like, what things do you encounter under the ocean? Like you sound like it's easy, just live under the water. But I'm thinking there's way more to it than that.
Yeah, there is a lot more, but it is so cool. I love it so much. It's my favorite thing in the world, actually, to do, because usually when we dive, we have to go down and we breathe air and we run out of air and we have to come back up to the surface again. But when you're an aquanaut, you go back into your house, which is on the bottom of the ocean. So it's almost like a school bus in the bottom of the ocean. I always think of like Miss Frizzle and the magic school bus. So we just swim back in and we get lunch and then we go back out again. And so when we're usually kind of rushing around trying to get work done on a regular dive, we get to spend time and get to know our neighbors while we're down there. So we get to see all the animals that are down there. And it actually gives you this moment to really feel like you're a fish.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
You said you go back into your house. What's an underwater house like?
The way I always think about it is I have fish tanks in my living room. And so I sit there and I look inside the fish tank and I imagine that I'm living underwater. And when you're living in Aquarius, it's exactly the opposite. The fish stop and you almost think they're doing this double take where they look at you like, what are you doing? And so you become the aquanaut in the fish tank. And then the fish are kind of peering at you through the windows, wondering what in the heck is going on with these crazy people who aren't supposed to be living in a bubble under the water.
Oh, that's wow. So cool. Yeah. Can you tell us some of the coolest animals that you've seen, creatures you've seen?
So one of the really neat things about underwater habitats is they attract fish and sometimes really big fish. And so there is this enormous fish called a grouper that we named her Sylvia, who after Dr. Sylvia Earle, who lives under the habitat. There's such a cool fish. It's this big fish about 6 feet long. It's about the same size as me.
Oh,
and they stun their prey by making noises. And so they make this noise in their chest that sends out this sound wave that stuns fish, and then they eat them. One of the really cool things, one of the missions I did, there was an octopus who laid her eggs outside of the window. So we sit there and we eat our lunch at our dinner at this little table looking out to the outside of the fish tank. And then we'd watch this octopus who would just constantly move the water over her eggs as they were developing, which is just amazing to see.
Oh, wow. I mean, that's just so cool. So I have to ask, were any of you stunned by the grouper?
Nah, none of us got that close to her, but yeah.
But, that was just
but it was in the back of my mind, you know, you always wonder. I mean, yeah, I mean, you hear dangerous things underwater, but my experience, if you leave underwater animals alone, they leave you alone right. as well. So
yeah, you keep a respectful distance.
Exactly. That's, yeah.
That's what, you know.
Although, I have one quick story.
Yeah.
I was underwater with a teacher. We took a teacher down with us. Her name is Colette Dryden, and we were doing work on the bottom. This is when we were working around Aquarius, but weren't yet living underwater. And she looked at me with the biggest eyes I think I've ever seen in a person, and then slowly pointed, and right under my leg was this giant moray eel that was slowly opening its mouth and closing, and it thought that I was just a nice rock to hide under. And so this big, probably 5-foot moray eel was sitting right under my leg, looking right at her, taking it all in, and, you know, of course it didn't hurt me, but it's, you know, it's one of those things that it's a little shocking.
Yeah. That's, you know, I mean, that's like having a snake or it's like in Florida where I live, you know, a crocodile or a gator sneak up on you. I mean,
exactly.
I would probably run, which is absolutely the worst thing to do.
Yeah. You don't want to scare it, but yeah.
Right.
Same thing. Yeah. Imagine a big boa constrictor kind of sneaking up and just kind of peeking out behind you.
I think I'd pass on that.
Dr. Brian, how long did it take for you to get to the point where you were like, okay, there's an eel underneath my foot. No need to worry.
Yeah, it's once you've done kind of some of the stuff long enough. I mean, I've fallen asleep underwater before when, you know, we're working at night and kind of, you know, how your head bobs and you kind of wake up and you're always, oh boy, I'm underwater. So yeah, it's like any job. Once you do it enough times, you start to get used to it. But, you know, it's, you know, even though you get used to it, it's still amazing.
So clearly you do a lot of training to do this. So tell our listeners, like, you're scuba qualled, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But do you have, what kind of qualifications do you have to learn? Like, if these kids want to become an aquanaut, what would they kind of have to do?
Yeah. So I started diving when I was 16 years old. I grew up in upstate New York and the Finger Lakes. And so we used to go diving on these shipwrecks that were in the Finger Lakes from the 1800s. And so I just grew up diving as much as I could. I went through training to be a rescue diver. At one point, we were scheduling a trip to go to Antarctica. And so I got trained as an EMT in diving to do diving rescues. But anybody that dives for science has to dive regularly and undergo first aid courses and CPR courses. Right. And even though it's really rare that something bad happens, we have to really be prepared for it. So really it's like anything else. You practice it. And even if you're not old enough to dive yet, I grew up playing around in the woods and, like you guys are talking about, problem solving. And it's great practice for when you're underwater.
Like how?
So when you're in the woods and you don't have any tools with you and you have to figure out how to solve it, you work with the stuff you have at hand. And that's pretty much the same thing underwater, that you have what you brought with you. But usually you're not able to kind of quick run back up to the boat or back to the shore. You have to stay down there. So whatever you brought with you, that's what you have to solve the problem.
Oh, so have you always wanted to be an aquanaut? You always wanted to be in the ocean?
Yeah, you know, for a little bit, I wanted to be an archaeologist and a paleontologist, but I'd say probably from when I was about 8 years old, I knew I wanted to be a marine biologist. I mean, I grew up in New York without any oceans around, but we had a lake, but my family used to go to the ocean once a year, and that was always just my absolute favorite thing to do. And of course, I grew up watching movies by people like Jacques Cousteau and saw the amazing underwater world. And so, yeah, I've kind of always wanted to do this.
Well, so one of the things we want to talk about on this show, since we are talking about problem solving, is tell us about your latest adventure / research project, which I know all about because I think it's very exciting, but let's share it with our listeners.
Yeah, this is so cool. So two ice ages ago, not the last ice age, but two ice ages ago, about 60,000 years ago, there was a cypress forest. It, over time, as the ice melted and sea levels rose again, we know that sea levels rise naturally, but it normally takes tens of thousands of years for that to happen. Now we're seeing a lot faster. Eventually that forest got covered by water and then got covered by dirt, by sediment that was building on top of it until it became buried. And it's been locked away for the last 60,000 years until a big hurricane came along, Hurricane Ivan came along and uncovered it. And so a couple of fishermen off the coast of Alabama started noticing they're catching a lot of fish, didn't know why, so they went to a dive shop. And people went out and dove, and they found an underwater forest, which sounds absolutely crazy. Yes. But there are stumps in place. There are branches everywhere. People have actually found some leaves even that are locked away. So what we were doing on this last trip we went down in December was we wanted to figure out what was living there, because much in line with this show, the way we know evolution works is it forces animals or the animals that are able to adapt to solve these problems over evolution are the ones that survive. And so living on wood is a really tricky thing to do. And so there are all these animals that only live on wood, and they've come up with these just amazing solutions for how to do that. And a lot of that involves making chemicals that allow them to do that. So part of our team wanted to go down and see what kind of chemicals they could find with to make medicine from it.
Right.
We were really interested to see what different kinds of animals there were, whether it was different from what was in the surrounding water. And so we were diving on this 60,000-year-old underwater forest, which was just mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. Were there, like, roads through this forest, like paths?
Yeah, so the place that we dove was actually an ancient riverbed. And so when we went down, you could easily imagine if you've ever been in kind of like a canoe or a boat, and you go along and see a forest that goes right up to the water's edge, and all the roots are sticking out, and the trees are right at the edge. That's a lot what it looked like, because you could see the tree roots sticking out. There was wood that was coming out that was buried in mud and kind of falling into what used to be this ancient riverbed. So we were just swimming along the edge of what used to be this river that was now 60 feet underwater.
Wow, that's really incredible. What was it like? How did you feel swimming along this river that was under the ocean?
To be honest, it was really spooky. So I've been diving for a really long time. But it was this beautiful sunny day. And so we were expecting to go down there and have everything go perfectly. We got down and it was like swimming in chocolate milk. We realized we couldn't see our hands in front of our faces. We knew that there were sharks in the area. And you know, even though they usually don't bother you, it still is in the back of your mind that you're swimming around and you can't see what's 2 feet behind you. So it was it was both exciting and a little spooky the first time we went down.
I mean, I don't even know what to say for that, right? like, how do you go down? That's like being in a completely dark room and then trying to have to move your way around, kind of like I assume you swim with your hands in front of you so you know what's coming. I mean,
yeah, it's almost like if you went into a dark room and you knew that there was a railing that you could hang on to, or you just put your hand on the wall, so you have something to touch. That's kind of what we would do, is we would go along and then swim along this bank and just kind of have our hand on the wall. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you went into a room that you've never been in before and you know that there are animals walking around in there in the dark with you, and you could walk into a big stump that you don't know is there. That's kind of what it was at that point, because we had flashlights, but they didn't work because there was just so much stuff in the water that it would just bounce back.
Did you accidentally touch any creatures when you were swimming around in the muck?
So I didn't, but one of the people I was diving with went down and put his hand on what he thought was a log, and it turns out it was a turtle. And all of a sudden it moved, and he jumped back because he could jump underwater because he put his hand on a turtle fin. I'm sure the turtle was surprised too.
Well, so I'm assuming, okay, I mean, I don't know if you know this, but animals can then see themselves. Can they see better than us in that type of medium, so to speak, where it's all, or do they just swim around and it doesn't bother them? Do you know?
There are some animals that can see in different ways than people do, but in that kind of environment, probably they were just mostly hunkering down. Or if you went a little farther up away from the bottom, you could see a little bit better. So I think they were probably just kind of hanging out in place while that was happening. Now, things like sharks do have other ways of sensing the prey than people do. So they probably were doing just fine down there. But again, you know, they
in fact, maybe they were doing really well because it was a good place to eat because the fish didn't know what they were doing.
You know, it could be, yeah.
So you were down there to take a look at things.
Yeah.
So how did, you know, we were talking about this a little bit before. So how did you solve the problem since everything is dark and you can't see anything? Were you able to get any data at all, or?
Yeah, we were. So what we did after that first dive, we came up to the boat, and you have to kind of wait in between dives. It's called off-gassing, and it doesn't mean you're sitting up there burping. It means that you're you're letting out all that compressed air that you breathed. And so we had a meeting and said, okay, this is a situation. What are we going to do next time? So what we tried, because part of what we wanted to do was to make a map of this place. And it reminded me a lot of, you ever heard that story about five people who are all feeling an elephant and one person's feeling the tail, one feeling the trunk, and they each come back with this different idea of what it was. One person thinks it's a snake. And that's really what we were doing down there, is we were just seeing like this little teeny tiny part of it. We wanted to know what else was down there. So we went down with this big measuring tape. We tied it off to the bottom of our buoy, and then we, each team swam off in a different direction. So say the first team went north and we went out for 100 feet, and then we would swing along at the end of the line and go clockwise. So it's almost like a pieces of a pie.
Oh my gosh.
Popping off one piece of the pie. Then we would go back and come back up, and the next dive team would come down and they'd start where we left off. So using that approach, we were able to at least see what else was down there. In a way that we weren't all going to the same place and we wouldn't all get lost. Because it's like, at least you can reel yourself back in at the end and know how to get back up to the boat.
Well, and I mean, if you're both going together, you could accidentally swim into each other and not even know it, right? Because you can't see the other person swimming, so you could just...
I when I first started diving, I used to wear really dark-colored gear, probably because I thought it was cool, and now I wear like really bright colored stuff because I want people to be able to find me if I get lost.
Dr. Brian, I'm wondering, when you're swimming around in the muck and you can't see your hand in front of your face, and I'm guessing your cell phone doesn't work down there, how do you communicate with each other?
Yeah, you learn hand signals. I mean, it really helps if you know the person you're diving with. And so the person I dove with was, his name is Francis Troy, and he's worked with me for a long time in my lab. He runs my lab. And so we know each other pretty well, and almost to the point where you can guess what the other person is thinking. But we use hand signals. We take down, we call them slates. It's basically a piece of plastic that a pencil can write on. And we tried that. The problem is that it was so dark down there with so much stuff in the water, you couldn't even read what we were writing on the slates. And so it was, we called it diving by Braille, because we were really kind of bouncing along really clumsily, trying not to run into things. But yeah, you need to rely on somebody else and work together.
It was disorienting, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, because if, you know, even when you dive, I know sometimes people can get disoriented, which is up and which is down, depending on where you are in the depth. But not being able to see, wasn't that like, were you still able to think that I'm upright, so up must be up, you know? I mean,
that was the nice thing about being able to touch something, because you're exactly right. So going back to what you're saying about being in a dark room, now imagine that you're not only going backwards and forwards, you're also able to climb the walls, or you're floating up and you don't know you're floating up until your head hits the ceiling. And so it's that importance of, I mean, this experiment, everybody, we could try. Turn off the lights in the room until it's really dark. Don't do it if there's anything you're going to really bump your head into. But it's really important just to be able to touch something, because it gives you that reference point of where you are, that you know you're in the bottom. And it's comforting. I mean, it was scary. I mean, I grew up thinking that scuba diving was all going to be, you know, being able to see for miles and miles underwater and these beautiful pristine waters. But you know, I found out that lots of times it's like this. It's like, you can't see anything, but you still have to get the job done. So you just sit down and remind yourself that, yeah, I know what I'm doing and I'm going to be careful and I've got other people with me who I trust, and you get it done.
So you give yourself a pep talk when you're done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, it's sometimes pretty scary down there, but I love it.
Well, and then, of course, we're talking that you're diving at 60 feet, right? So you can't just go up really fast if you get nervous or whatever, right? You have to be aware of the depth.
Yeah, you can really get hurt if you do that. And so when you're breathing out of a scuba tank, all that air is squished into the tank at high pressure, and then you breathe it, and your body is under pressure too. And so if you come up too fast, it makes bubbles in your blood or in your lungs that can really, really hurt you. And so you really have to make sure you come up slowly. You don't hold your breath. That's part of the training that you do.
Because that, to me, would be my instinct. If I would have touched the turtle, I'd have been like, I'm out of here, man.
You know, that's one of the first things that they really drill into you when you live in the bottom, when you're an aquanaut. Because then your body is like, you're taking like a Coke can and you shake it up to like spray it on your sister. I used to do that to my little sister. It's the same thing. That's all those bubbles. And when that kind of explodes, it's all the carbon dioxide bubbles that's in a soda can. When you're living in the ocean for a long time, that's what happens to your body. So you cannot go to the surface. So they really drive it home. You stay on the bottom. If you get into trouble, you go back to the habitat. You do not go to the surface. So I'd have that training, which helped.
I'm wondering, Dr. Brian, what was the most amazing thing you learned from this expedition?
So it was almost like stepping back in time to see something that was 60,000 years old. And one thing I should have said is when we pulled this wood out, it looked like something that you could throw in a fireplace. It was all the colors are there. The bark was still on there and it was locked away. And to know that it had been locked away in this pristine vault, I guess is what kind of want to think about it. And that we were discovering it. It was this reminder that there is so much out there that we don't know yet. I mean, this was really rare, but there are probably more places like this. I mean, it's absolutely true that we know more about the surface of the moon than we do the bottom of the ocean. And so there's all this stuff out there to discover that we have no idea about. This was just like looking at one little tiny piece of that. So that to me was the most amazing thing. It was just this really cool reminder of how much there is to do in the ocean.
Dr. Brian, one of our listeners, Stephanie, she has a question for you.
I was wondering if you need more people to become aquanauts.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we need a lot more aquanauts. we need a lot more people to start exploring the ocean.
Well, because you guys have only explored what? There's a percentage. What is it? 3%, 5%?
It's like less than 5% or something like that.
It's less than 5%.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something really, really small. And so there's just so much to do. And the ocean provides so much. Every other breath we take is oxygen from the ocean, right?
Yep.
And so we're really kind of racing to try to figure out how the ocean works.
This has been amazing for me because I love learning about all this. And of course, I think the science is awesome. Do you have anything that you'd like to say to kids who maybe want to become aquanauts or study marine biology?
Yeah, do it. Please do it. you really need people. And I guess the one thing is that there's no one right way to do it. There's no like set path you have to do first this and then this. It's all figuring out what you're good at and following your passions. So I have colleagues who are really good at photography or artwork. I have others who are really good at storytelling. Some people I work with are really good engineers. And so there are all these different strengths that you can bring to the table. So I think it's figure out what you love to do and then just practice it. And it's never too early to start practicing that and learning everything you can.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I mean, you know, when my background is I started a science club in my garage when I was 7, and here I am all these years later, you know, talking to scientists. And while I don't always get to go out in the field, I'm so excited to learn about stuff like this. It's like the little kid in me is going, oh my gosh.
Well, exactly. That's exactly what we need. I mean, that's, I think, inside every scientist is a kid who gets really excited about this stuff. I mean,
it's
amazing. It's an amazing world out there.
Dr. Brian, you're right. It is an amazing world. And this has been an amazing interview. And I just love learning all about being an aquanaut. But, you know, we would like to make our show totally interactive. So right now, it's time for
The Challenge.
Brian, on Solve It, we like to have a challenge for all of our listeners. So what challenge do you have for our listeners today?
Sure. So the challenge we faced was having to dive underwater where we couldn't see anything. So what I would want everyone to do is to make their own forest. You can make it out of anything. Make it something soft so you don't bump your head. But make it out of pillows. Make it out of cardboard. Make your own underwater forest someplace in your living room and do what we did. Run a string through it, run anything through it that you can follow with your hands. And then just to make it more fun, let's make your parents do it too. So why don't you hide something in there, like some pennies or some candy, and say, all right, mom and dad, here's a blindfold. I want you to be an aquanaut and find your way through the forest without being able to see.
That sounds awesome. So if you guys do this, take a picture of it and then make sure you send it to us. Tag us on Twitter or Instagram. We are at KidsSolve. And we would love to see these pictures as your parents or you. You can do it for you, too. Try and struggle their way through. And we'll make sure that we tag Brian, and maybe he will give you some tips or just comment on all of your funny pictures.
Absolutely. And if you'd want to have a lot of fun, pretend you're a shark and jump out and scare them while they're doing it.
That would be even better. Awesome. All right. Have fun with that, kids.
Jennifer, that was awesome. I learned so much. Dr. Brian was amazing.
He is amazing, isn't he? Yes, Brian Helmuth knows a lot about a lot of cool things. And just think what amazing things future aquanauts like all of you out there are going to learn about the ocean.
I know, like maybe one of the kids out there is going to become an aquanaut and discover a cure for going bald. I would love that. And I can't wait to see the pictures of the kids exploring their worlds blindfolded. Safely, of course.
Safely, of course. I am so excited about this. And if your parents give you permission to post these pictures on social media, please be sure to tag us at KidsSolve at either Twitter or Instagram. And we will share them with Dr. Helmuth, and maybe he'll even comment on them.
Hey, remind me, Jennifer, if families want to find out more about Dr. Brian's work, where can they go?
So they can go. Be sure to visit our website, www.solveitforkids.com. So there, not only are we going to have the challenge listed, but we'll have some cool links that you can take a look at to learn more about Dr. Brian. And also, I believe he's going to send us some videos so you can see what it's like to swim underwater.
Awesome.
And finally, we'll have a cool book list. So if you want to find out more, we will have a list of kids' books that you can go check out from your local library and learn more about being an aquanaut.
Hey, speaking of books, where can families go to find out more about the awesome books that you've written?
So you can go to my website, which is www.jenniferswansonbooks.com.
Hey, kids, don't forget that we would love it if you become part of our Solve It for Kids team. We'd love to give you a shout-out here in the show, and maybe we'll get a chance to use one of your questions on a future episode of the show.
See you next time!
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.